And hello, Francesco, and I invited you, Fabrizio, just now.
Hi there. Hi
Hiya,
Daniel.
how's it going?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having us. How are you
No
doing?
worries, no worries at all. And thank you guys for joining. We're just waiting for Fabrizio to connect as well, and then
Hey
we can get
there.
started. Hello, how's it going,
Hey,
Fabrizio?
nice to be here. Nice, thank you.
Lovely, lovely. I have to start by saying this is the first time we're having two people on an AMA. So I'm betting on your guys' synergy when it comes to taking on answers. So I guess this is not necessarily the first time for you guys doing an interview together.
We kind of always do it like this. So, yeah,
Lovely.
we are used to it. Yeah.
Lovely. So there's nothing new specifically for you guys. Cool. So what we're doing is really simple. Hello to everybody. Hey CB, hey Tom, hey Patrick, hey everybody, thanks for being here. We just want to have a quick chat, the three of us, for like, let's say 10, 15 minutes, just to get the ball rolling, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Is that okay?
Sure. Let's do
Lovely.
this.
Lovely.
Perfect.
The first thing I want to touch upon, so that we can get into the topics. We'll get into male brew and typhoid in a bit, but I'm curious to know, what has your guys' experience been when it came to indie hacking, so to speak, and being in Europe? So we used to start off being very Silicon Valley centric, but now with this new movement of indie developers or indie hackers, but I call you guys indie as well, because it's mainly not necessarily about being alone, but being not on the treadmill of VC money, so choosing bootstrap and all that. So, back to my main question. How has your experience been with being in Europe?
I mean, these days we feel like it's really location is not that important at all, and I think also that many people share this belief, especially with COVID and with remote going being the new default. I think actually being in Europe could be an advantage because you can. I mean, we know many more founders that. Even if they take VC money, they are based in Europe. They have access to cheaper talent, and actually, I think could be an advantage being in Europe. That's what I'm saying.
I understand. Fabrizio, what has your experience been so far? If you have something to add to Francesco's thoughts.
Basically the same. I mean, we're used to our lifestyles here. We traveled a lot, but in the end, at least for now, we enjoy our lives here. And also, as Francesco was saying, the cost of many things here is lower. So building a company from scratch here has some advantages compared to the United States, for example. So at least for now, it's working out pretty nicely.
Lovely. I'm glad to hear that. And yes, I guess this is part of this new movement, which isn't necessarily that new, I would say, but it's been an uprising, at least lately, with this wave of being by yourself. So I'm pretty glad to know that more and more people are getting into this mental structure, because the old structure used to be different, and you guys are, I would say, at the forefront of it. I'll get into that in a second when we talk about how your life has been while building these. But I want to move on to Mail Brew now. So your homepage is pretty simple. You can barely scroll, and the scroll is just for a informational footer, although that's not necessarily a footer. How has that been? So how hard is it to keep it that simple?
It's been quite a process, honestly. We actually started with much bigger landing page that grew over time. And I mean, this is a classic phenomenon, even with product building itself. You start from something simple, and then you add a feature here, a feature there, and you end up with this bloated product. And then you have to cut back. To find the core again, what you're building. And in a way, we did the same with this landing page. And actually, it was Francesco that at some point said maybe we should try to do something a bit bold, even if the landing page is working pretty nicely in terms of conversion. I think it had around 8 to 9% conversion rate from visitor to sign up. We thought we could do much better than that, and we also thought like Mailbrew is a product that you really at least for now you have to explain a little bit what it is if you really want to make people understand everything that it can do. But we thought maybe let's try to simplify the landing page so much that it's almost like you're just subscribing to a newsletter, and then let's just let the product itself make the user discover all the features, all the benefits. But the purpose of the landing page in our eyes was just let's make users jump in because it looks like something frictionless that they can do, and it's interesting enough to leave their email. And so yeah, we basically removed everything, starting from scratch with a Morning Brew style landing page we just sign up for. And it was also funny because when we did that, Morning Brew switched to a big landing page and abandoned their simple email sign-up box style page. But yeah, in the end, it worked out very well. And we almost doubled the conversion rate in the landing page with this change. So we're pretty happy with it. But we don't want to stop there. We're still testing, and we want to experiment stuff like having the animation or not, or having some more testimonials under the fold and stuff like that.
It looks great, I have to say. And I didn't know the page from back when it had way more stuff, but I know it was 90% plus chances that, because that's what you do, right? You start with the usual, which is add a lot of stuff. So I kind of, in the simplicity, I kind of read between the lines, and I could tell, oh, them two probably had something simple, but then they said no, we just want, sorry, they two had something complicated, but eventually they scrapped that for something simple. So you double conversion rates, Morning Brew changed. What's coming up next in terms of how you decide, because you keep adding more stuff as time goes by, whether that's features or, as you said, the testimonials. How is going to be your process for deciding what stays in and what has to stay out?
Frank, you want to take this one?
You mean in terms of feature or as regard to the landing page?
Anything. I mean, you guys are going to keep adding features, whether more or fewer, you're going to add some as time goes by, and more stuff is going to happen. So my question is more, let me phrase it this way. Apple or you name it, different companies are praised for simplicity. And you guys are simple and are doing a good job at it. The numbers speak for themselves. What is your process for deciding what you're cutting out when you're simplifying and what to keep in?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't have a formalized process, but what we do is that we dog food our own products. We use them every day. So we let this guide us in deciding what to keep and what to remove. And recently, I mean, over the past few months, we kept adding new features. But now we are more in a refinement phase and we want to remove more and more. And basically, we want to focus on the core of what both Mailbrew and Typefully are and remove everything else. It was worth trying. And but especially as with a small team, and we want to stay a small team, have some teammates, but we don't want to grow to be a huge company. I mean, it's really important to stay focused and do a few things very, very well. Exploration has a role in trying lots of stuff, but you need to be as quick to dismiss them as you are to implement and try them, I think. Because I've been thinking quite a bit about this recently. If you keep adding stuff, at some point the maintenance cost will be so big that you could be doing maintenance 24/7. And
Yeah.
we are not at that point, but we are starting to feel the burden of doing so much that we want to take a step back and focus on what's really working and make it work even more.
I understand. And so you said it's more of a gut feeling, more of how you interact with the product. But walk me through what goes through your mind or maybe it's just 100% gut feeling and you're like in a mindful state. When you look at the 10, especially now, as you said, you're skimming down. When you look at the 10 features, and let's say and they're all crying for you to keep them alive, but you have to cut somebody off, some of them off. What goes on through your mind then?
Yeah, so let me walk you through it. So we have this product, Mailbrew, which for everyone that doesn't know, it's this product that lets you, let's say, unplug from the internet by creating a personal daily newsletter with your own sources, completely customizable. And this is the core of it. But for example, on top of that, you have this newsletter reader. We give you an email address and you can send your newsletters there. And it's also a read later app because you can save links that you find while reading your mail brews. And so it's a lot. The fact that you need to use an and to describe what the product does, it's already a kind of a warning sign. So basically, we tried all of these different features, but even talking with users, it's clear that there is one main use case, and then there are 10% of people using that feature, 10% using that other feature. Then so this is actually not only gut feeling. It's talking with users, keeping a conversation going, and mm-hmm. also realizing that the way you yourself are using it may not be matching, or your users are using it. So it's combining all these inputs and your own vision for the product in deciding what to keep and what to remove.
That makes sense.
And also, if I can add something, there's also, like, usually when we prioritize features and we decided what to build in the past, we discussed a lot of stuff, and then sometimes we said, this looks super cool, we really want to add this, and we started working on it. Usually now, we ask ourselves, does this move the needle? Which is a very simple phrase, but for us it means, like, is this something that really has a big impact for us, for the company, for the business? For example, does it significantly change revenue or engagement or retention? And so all of this is like, in this simple phrase, does it move the needle? So we always ask ourselves this now when we prioritize, and it changed a lot of conversation, because now sometimes we catch ourselves discussing things that don't move the needle. And so we stop right away and we say, wait, we shouldn't even discuss this. Like, it's super cool. Maybe there's AI or there's some cool stuff there that we want to use, but it doesn't move the needle. So let's just discuss something else.
That makes sense. And would I be right to guess, Fabrizio, that you got to this habit of checking yourself in with this question of, does it move the needle? After doing multiple things that, you know, took a lot of time and were nice to make, but didn't actually bring any, like, have you grown this habit into yourself through the, I don't have a better word, through the pain of spending time, multiple times on something that didn't add up to too much?
Yeah, totally. Like, everything we do now, all the things we learned, it was like through mistakes. And it was like a mistake we did a few times, more than I want to admit, to just add stuff for the sake of it, or because at that specific moment we were excited about something. So yeah, after a few times we realized, wait, we worked a ton in the last few months, for example, but then we remember just two or three very meaningful things we did. So probably there was a lot of noise, a lot of unnecessary work, and that's when the shift happened.
So you both got the scar tissue, so to speak, behind this experience of, right, lovely. I want to go a bit off script, getting back to the point Francesco was making about talking to your users. Just like I did earlier of, you know, I called it gut feeling, but then and that's why I wanted to go a bit deeper, because it isn't just gut feeling in the, not only in the artistic way, but there's more to it. Francesco, you were talking about talking to your users and how that helps. Walk us through, myself and the audience, about how talking to your users has been for you guys, because the numbers show it that you've been doing it well. is it fewer aha moments, but the overall average of the feedback, you know, and that sinks in after a couple of days or weeks? Is it a fewer aha moments, but more of the average that's driving? Do you have a lot of aha moments when you speak to users? What happens there?
Yeah, so we spoke to users before launching the product, and now we even we were keeping it as an ongoing practice. So it really has been a guiding principle in using it as a like as the, this metric to assess everything we do. And I think in different phases it has a different level of it's a different signal. At the beginning, to understand if what you're doing makes sense at all, presenting it to people without passing judgment and seeing if they understand what it is about, if they're excited, that was hugely important. We manually onboarded the first 10 users and fixed a ton of UX problems that way. It makes a huge difference because especially in the onboarding flows, everyone has to go through that. So it's really a leaking pipe if you don't take care of that stuff, and you kind of lose touch of it working on the product every day. So it's important to constantly expose the product to new people and observe how they use it to get their feedback. Mm-hmm. And then, as I was saying, we kept this conversation going with users by scheduling calls with them regularly. We offer this Patreon plan where people can pay a bit more to get on a call with us, mm-hmm. Share their feedback. So we kept also the conversation going that way. And it was really important for us because it really gave us a sense of how people are using it and what they care about and what they don't. And I will give a very concrete example here. For Mainbrew, we have been focusing pretty heavily on our web app. It's this progressive web app that you can use to read your brews and your newsletters and your read later items. And we like spent a ton of time on it. We can say 80% of the development time went there since the start, I would say. But actually, talking with users over and over, we kept hearing just one thing, that people actually read and love to read their digest in their email, and we kind of ignored that. But recently, I mean, we also start tracking a bit better how actually people are reading this, are reading their digests, and users were right in telling us that their daily email is the most important thing about Mailbrew. And that actually made us prioritize and decide to invest more on that. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's really important to... it's like a thermometer. You need it to steer you in the right direction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I want to move a bit to the audience now and invite them. So I'll come with the next question, but after this, I'd love to start getting some questions from the audience for Francesco and Fabrizio, because this is an AMA after all. I just want to let the audience know, if for some reason you guys can't speak at the moment, or you're just a bit shy, or for whatever reason, feel free to DM me. I can be the voice for your question. I'll just read your question out loud from the DM, and we can have it that way as well. My last question before handing over to the audience, Francesco and Fabrizio, how has your experience been with not having a public pricing page on Mailbrew?
I mean, we had it at some point. Right now, we don't have it because we have been actually experimenting with pricing. We run a three months long A/B test, so with different pricing strategies. So we don't have it right now because of that. Mm-hmm. But there is and there isn't any other reason for that. We had it before running that the test.
So the question is, how did it affect in any way, or was it exactly the same when you've removed the page?
We didn't see any I mean, some users complained that we weren't really that upfront with pricing on the website before signing up, but after you sign up, it's immediately clear that it's a paid product with some limitations if you don't pay.
I understand. Cool. While we're still waiting for questions, I'll move on to Typefully. And I've been a user of Typefully and I love it. Tell us in the audience how, as much or as little as you guys feel like sharing, how did Typefully come up? How is it going along? And how close you say it is? Is it hand in hand with Mailbrew? Do you want to separate them more in the future? Walk us through the story of Typefully.
Yeah. Fab, you want to do it? Because actually, I think it's your baby. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I can start for sure. Basically, it started as also other things that we do and we did in the past. It started as a simple side project, basically, that I had on the side. Because during our time building stuff together, I started building more and more of the front end. And so I also became a front-end engineer during these years of building stuff together. And some of these side projects were like a testing ground for me to improve my skills. And we've always been like huge advocates of side projects, even where we're very busy building stuff like Mailbrew. And so in that case, it was like a couple of weekends or work for this prototype of this little app to create Twitter threads. And it was super simple. You couldn't even tweet because I can do anything backend related. So it was purely front end. You just started typing and you saw a preview of the thread on the side. And then also when we worked with someone that helped us with growth and marketing at some point, we realized that there was like a big marketing side projects potential for this, also because of the affinities with Mailbrew. Because if Mailbrew allows you to unplug from feeds with a daily digest, in a way you could use Typefully to unplug from the Twitter feed and just focus on the writing part. So at least some of the values of this project were similar to some of the Mailbrew ones, and so we decided to spend a few weeks on it to see if it worked as a marketing side project. And it worked very, very well. We got a ton of signups. And if at the start we were using it mostly to drive signups to Mailbrew, for example, there was a big buy Mailbrew in the header of the app. And there was also a Mailbrew model where we directly plug the product. During time, we realized that there's a lot of word of mouth around it. So we, even without doing any kind of marketing or promotion, we constantly have new signups to Typefully. Also because it's almost completely free until now. And then we also realized the monetization potential. Because even with a very simple feature set, there were a ton of people saying, I would already pay for this. Are there going to be pro features, paid features, and stuff like that? And so it's still a product that is very tied to a strategy we have that is building a kind of army of Twitter products. So these products that aim at a Twitter pro or semi-pro audience, like Mailbrew itself in many ways. And we want to build more so they can work together and become almost like a little system. And Typefully, of course, has a big role in this strategy. So in that way, for sure, it's a team player. At the same time, it's almost a little startup by itself at this point, because we're seeing that it has already great conversion rate from these early adopters, and there's a lot of interest for the pro feature. So in the future, I think we'll invest more time into it, and at the same time we'll always think about how to integrate it in our strategy and make it work for Mailbrew as well. And for example, when we're going to launch some pro features for it, for sure, if we start sending a digest of these features to the users, for example, a daily digest on your Twitter impressions on your account metrics, we'll use Mailbrew for it. So in the end, there's always going to be like tight integrations between these products, even if we develop them almost as they're completely different startups. I hope that answered the question.
It does. It does for sure. Just to clarify, so Typefully wasn't planned to be a product you guys make and then pre-sell and turn into a completely separate, I guess it is completely separate now as well, but it wasn't meant to be this new startup, was it?
No, absolutely not
at all. Actually, it's pretty funny because, we tried to implement this marketing side project strategy. We tried the blog posts, SEO, all kind of stuff. But actually, what we are best at is creating products, and we are kind of fast at it, especially with simple concept like Typefully was before these most recent features. So we just built it with an insane level of quality. And when you do stuff like that, at least for us, it works really great because people share it. And it brought, as Fabrizio was saying, hundreds of signups to Mailbrew. But then we also discovered the other nice benefit of launching new stuff is that you always learn something that you didn't know with another product. Like with Typefully, the completely new thing for us was having a product with a growth loop inside. So when some huge accounts signed up and started tweeting with it, we have probably thousands of people every day seeing mm-hmm. when you open a tweet detail, you can see like where it was tweeted from. So I think it's kind of growing by itself, which is super cool, and we will definitely not launch any other product that does not have a growth loop in it, because it's really that great to have growth basically take care of itself.
Yeah, 100%. Kind of like, and I have looked this up because it was very interesting. I see Shar from Billflow in the audience, and he has as well. One of the things that I'm going to mention is, just like you guys have it, I looked it up, and apparently there's, you know, with exceptions, there's three main things you can do to grow with your users. One of the things is, as you said, have that badge there, kind of like Help Scout or Intercom or written with Typefully in Twitter. Some other people do it in pop-ups. And the third way would be if you host a page, think status page or stuff like that. So, I like to hear that you guys said this as a bit of a high standard, but not a standard for future projects, not to have this viral loop. I want to remind the people that they can click the button in the lower left corner so they can request the mic for a question. Francesco and Fabrizio are happy to answer anything for you guys. Until we get a request, let me dive a bit deeper into this Typefully experiment or side product that became a main product in itself. How do you guys think of value for the end user? Because I guess in a way I'm trying to ask you what caused Typefully success. You've touched upon this growth thing, but I'm more interested in the idea phase. So you imagine something that turned out to be valuable to people. What is value to you guys? And how do you imagine, like, do you just simulate a scenario in your head and you think, are people going to use this? Walk me through for your mindset in the idea process and in the building and readjusting and all that.
Yeah, basically, are kind of, we have seen this trend of people basically, people are using Twitter like blogs, especially with threads. They are sharing these nuggets of knowledge. Or the basic initial idea was to create a focused writing environment. Like I don't know if you know the EA Writer app, like mm-hmm. this beautiful. Writing up with no distraction, but build it in a way that's native to Twitter with a live preview that matches almost 100% how it will be when you publish it. Mm-hmm. So that was the basic nugget as a marketing side project. And people loved it. So we then thought, how can we expand this to be even more useful to people actually to people doing what we do, using Twitter as a way to grow an audience and build products and basically as a way to market yourself and your startup. And the missing piece there was what we then added, we are still working on it, which is schedule, even more powerful scheduling. We shipped as part of Typefully Pro a scheduling calendar. And the other part, a big one, is analytics. So actually, that helps you in understanding what you post works. Is it working? Is it not? What's working? So in guiding you in deciding what to write about. And there are some tools, even Twitter itself offers some analytics. But I mean, I'm pretty excited because I was just working on it before joining the space. We have some novel ideas on how to present data and how to. I mean, I think there hasn't really been a tool that took this to where we see it. It could be as a way to really help you and guide you in growing your Twitter following. So this is we are planning also a big launch around this, so it's gonna be fun.
Fantastic. Fabrizio, can we get your input as well on the thought process? And by the way, Francesco, you're on design and Fabrizio is on coding. Am I right here?
It's the other way around.
Oh, damn it. My research hasn't been
No,
successful.
the lines are blurring, don't worry. No, but yeah, no, it's the other way around. And no, regarding the process, Francesco explained everything perfectly. And I just want to add that in general, we still always start from what it's useful to us. There's a ton of stuff we could do to plan products and decide what to do next, like market research on see like what's trending and stuff like that. But in our history of building stuff on the internet, we always felt that if we start from what we specifically need, it's always more fun to work on anything. And also usually if you need something and you know how to build it, it's probably something that you have a unique skill set for. In some way, of course, you might need to do something, and you're not equipped to work on it. But for sure, in our conversation, that was we were always starting from like this is something that I would really love to have, I would really love to use, or this is something that I really need, and tons of other people would probably love this as well. That's almost always the start of this conversation, at least. Then, of course, there are other considerations like. Is this something we can properly monetize? Because there are some cool ideas that would be very, very difficult to monetize. And so, of course, we wouldn't go there. We usually start from something that can also be profitable fast because we like being profitable. Even with a small seed round, we still focus on profitability and having big leeway and being able to sustain ourselves. We like just doing it that way. So yeah, those are the things that we usually focus on when we decide what to work on.
Makes sense, but let's sit a bit more on this. And we just had the first request, but it went away. If the person that was willing to ask a question can click that again, I can add them. Let's sit there for a second. You said this. You mentioned this topic that is widely discussed on the internet of building for yourself. What would you tell the people who build something for themselves, but due to whatever reason, an echo chamber, whatever, they build something for themselves, but they can't sell it? You already mentioned you have a couple of standards, such as can we monetize this? I know you guys made a post on Indie Hackers a couple of months ago, if not last year, which was we gave ourselves 6 months to make our company work. What would you tell these people who made something for themselves as well, but just failed at making a business there?
Sure, I think that there could be like a ton of problems that I'm not like the biggest expert on this. So of course, like take my advice with a grain of salt. But I think what like there are some areas where I would look for a problem. And One area, for example, is there some kind of signaling component that I'm missing, for example, because people usually would gladly pay for something that helped them signal something to others. So if you remember, for example, the Crazy Hey launch, the email service by the Basecamp guys, it was hugely successful, I think, in large part due to the address itself that you got. If I had to bet, I'd say that 70, 80% of the people would have used it, tried it, or upgraded anyway, even with a slightly worse service, because there was like this huge signaling component. And so I think there are some products that are very, very good, but then basically you can just use them for yourself, so that there's really no signaling component there. And that's something, also something that we're really still working on. So we're not very strong in this regard, actually, but it's something that crossed my mind recently. And another thing is, like, does this product really help the user, like, save a ton of time or save his attention or clarity of mind or energy? Like, is there really some tangible value for the end user, or is it just a nice to have? And it sounds like a simple question, but most of the time, founders and even ourselves tend to reply, no, it's not a nice to have. It's essential because of this, because of that. And most of the time, it's actually just a nice to have. And Mailblue itself, for a very long time, was actually just a nice to have. And we're still working very, very hard to make sure that it's not just a nice to have, but it's more. And it becomes actually an essential part of people's routine. But it's a work in progress. We're still getting there after more than a year of working on it. So I think it's probably the biggest struggle to make products essential. But it's where I would look for a problem if a product is really struggling to monetize.
Interesting. And I hope maybe now live, maybe on the recording, some people are going to take what you said and apply it. And hopefully you have prevented somebody from wasting a year, two or three, I'm hoping. Outside the startup world, you guys haven't been sharing a lot, like, you know, making your profiles the main topic for lifestyle design, such as, I don't know, Daniel Vassal or somebody else. But I got a strong feeling that both of you guys are optimizing for lifestyle design. You're definitely not jumping on the VC treadmill, although you did get some seed and you mentioned that. But still, I think you guys, and I'm praising you here for this, you're getting the best of both worlds. So you're trying to stay lean, as you mentioned earlier, and make that leeway and make a profitable product ASAP while de-risking with some seed funding when you needed it. Talk to us about how you guys optimize your lifestyle, or how lifestyle shapes the business life and the other way around. Either of you or both of you?
Yeah, I can take this one. Yeah, it has been a process. Starting a startup and working on products is taxing, but the thing we love most about it is the complete flexibility that we have in deciding how to work, what to work on, and when to work. So what we've been trying to do, it has been a process over these years, is to create at a very concrete level, create like a daily routine and life that actually is enjoyable and we want to live. And concretely, this means mixing a kind of a lot of stuff that some companies focus on uniquely. For example, some companies are all in on working at an office and take office space and say that you need to be there from 9 to 5. Some other companies go fully remote and completely async, even on different time zones. We do a mix, and that's what has worked best for us until now. So for example, what we do is that we have a physical office that we go to in the afternoon. And by default, we are remote and async. We We rely heavily on threads and try to communicate without requiring the other person to be there 100% of the time, and this leaves us free to take a walk in the middle of the day, to do sports, and basically enjoy life as it happens instead of at specific hours. And I mean, it has been great. And the other thing we try to do is to make it fun by traveling and changing location often. Not that much these days, but actually we are starting again because soon we will be vaccinated. And I mean, any other curiosity about this?
Yeah, was it you, Francesco, or Fabrizio, who posted the wall the other day that looked really nice? I think I commented as well.
Fabrizio,
walk us through your design acumen on interior design this time, not digital.
No, I don't actually think I have like that much of a like interior design taste or something like that. But actually, to continue on something that Francesco was saying, like recently I moved apartment. And that's why you might have seen a couple of pictures because I'm starting to design the space a little bit more like to make it feel a bit more like myself compared to the previous apartment. And for example, I did this with almost zero stress because like I know that we can communicate our times and make space for personal tasks like this. And when I used to have like a more normal tech day job, this kind of stuff felt like a burden for me. I always thought like, when will I be able to really make time for this? Or how in advance should I schedule this kind of stuff? And will it work with the current projects and stuff like that? So usually, yeah, basically you have to fit your life around work. And now as Francesco was saying, it's almost like the other way around. And we both really love what we're working on. So it's not just, we don't just want to work the least amount of time possible. It's not about that. It even happens that we actually work a little bit during weekends because there's something that we really want to work on. But yeah, in the end, basically, we make sure that there's like a good balance between life and work, which is something everyone is talking about these days. But it really, it's a struggle and we're always working to make it a more fair balance, both for work and for life, for both of them.
Cool. I've got more to ask, but we've got Akash. I'm adding him as a speaker now. He's got a question, so I'll hold off to my questions, and I'll just post it as a text question on Reddit SaaS after this. Hello, Akash. Can you hear us?
Loud and clear.
Welcome.
Thank you. So shall I ask my question or wait for you?
Yes, please go ahead. No, okay. No hesitation.
Okay. So thanks for hosting this space. My question was around, you know, talking to users. We all know that, you know, this is a very obvious thing to talk to users. Everybody is talking about it. But we also know that it's the most difficult thing to do, right? I still get nervous whenever I have to do a user interview or something like that. So how do you define a most successful user interview? Like, what are those things, or do you have any metrics which tells you that this was a good interview and I got so much of signals out of it? So what are those signals? It could be around pricing, it could be around prioritizing your features, or it could be around adding those must have or good to have.
Interesting question.
Yeah, super interesting question. Thanks for it. And I speak for myself, but personally, like we had a little framework for these interviews, but usually we use this framework. It's like a list of questions, but we usually use it just to break the ice and start the interview. And then we go from there because every user is different. So it's good to have a little framework, but it's super important to see what kind of person you have in front of you and ask questions that make sense for that specific user. And also I remember being a lot of, very nervous during the first interviews because I felt that it was a more formal process than it is actually. And recently, with the last user interviews that we did, I've been much more casual, almost like when I'm talking to a friend who's using Mailbrew and wants to tell me what he thinks. And it's much, much better. The interviews go more smoothly this way. And in terms of how to understand if the interview itself has any value, the only question I ask myself is, did I learn something about my product that I didn't know? Because if everything that the user told me in some ways was already on my radar, it's not super useful. Like, I mean, it's useful because there's always some data that you can use, but I love asking questions almost always out of the frameworks that we use that in some way trigger the users to tell me something that I didn't know or I didn't think, some kind of use cases that were out of our mind. And that's when the magic happens, because you discover all these use cases and ways to engage with the product that you weren't aware of. And the last thing I want to mention, I don't remember who specifically gave us this advice. Maybe Manuel, who is listening right now, is in the audience. Manuel Frigerio, another startupper. But someone said, make sure to never put your own words onto the user when you interview them. So when we started the interview, the very first ones, I remember saying, hello, thanks for joining. So Mailbrew is this and that, or are you using this specific feature? Now these days, after breaking the ice a little bit, I just test them. So what do you think? Or how are you engaging with the product without using any adjectives or descriptions of the product? Because you really want to hear how they're describing your product. And that's also super useful, because sometimes they describe it with words that really tell you a lot of the perception of the product that you weren't really aware of. Hope this answers the question.
Absolutely, yeah. Super helpful.
Thank you.
Can I go for the second
one? Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So before, we as a first-time makers or creators, we always hesitate to, monetize whatever we are building, right? Always there is a small fear in your mind that shall we charge it or not? Shall we, whether the user will pay it for it or not? So what is that break-even point where you think that, okay, this is the right time to start charging for your product? And what was that moment, while you was building? Which was that point where you guys have decided that, okay, this is the point and these are the things we should be charging for?
Okay, I will take this one. So the answer is that there is, I hate to give this answer, but there is no right answer about this. Depends on what you are trying to do. Because actually we have had extremely great experience with the charging from the start and with not charging at all, which is respectively Mailbrew and Typefully. When you ask people for money from the start, it's you're limiting the amount of signal that you get in terms of are people liking it, are they using it, because you put a barrier up front. And I think if we made Typefully paid from the start, we completely locked, you need to pay to use this, it wouldn't be what it is today, which is in a much better place. So it's kind of a tough question. So if I'm summarizing my thought on this, if you're optimizing for, building a B2B company because you want to leave your job, then by all means, I think it makes sense to charge from the start, because the biggest risk there is that people are not willing to pay at all for your product. But if you're exploring a space like this, Twitter writing tool, and maybe also want to build an audience or you're just approaching indie, I think it, building free products and see where they go, eventually monetizing them later as a, definitely as a place. My mind on this has changed with the experience we've had with Typefully. I think free products have a place. And when you really see that they start to grow and to then you can you can basically test very quickly whether people are willing to pay with them for them, which is what we did with Typholy. Testing the monetization was one day of work. Basically, we asked a few questions and gave people the option to lock a price. At that point, we knew that we had to build those paid feature because the signal was so high that we couldn't ignore it.
Fantastic. Thank you for answering that. We've got Eugenie up next with her question. Hello, Eugenie. Welcome.
Hey, Daniel. Okay. So first of all, thank you again for hosting such a wonderful space. And so as you both guys have mentioned, that Typholy was a kind of a side project initially. So which were the signals which told you that this could be a full-time thing, and also how you interpreted its initial journey?
The main signal was the at least for me was the increasing number of daily signups. Usually the way it goes is that you launch a product, you get a few hundred signups on launch day, and then it kind of dies off. And with Typholy, we did this great launch with thousands of signups. And then it didn't die off. It started, it decreased a bit, but then there was this organic core of daily signups that kept growing. And that was that. I don't know if you listened from the start, but it goes to that growth loop that everyone is looking for in their products. And when you find a product that has it, you get this slow build up of signups that keeps progressively growing and really helps you in. When you have that and people are also willing to pay for that product, I think it's. It's the holy grail in the hacking, yeah.
And also, if I can add something, and thanks for the question, of course. There are some products where you start seeing that kind of growth. Maybe it's a linear growth. It's not really exploding, but you see that kind of growth, but you're not really sure where to go from there to improve upon it. With Typholy, we almost instantly understood that there were like a ton of features that we could build that could be like core features of the product. So not just nice to haves or little additions. For example, a whole growth feature set to help people understand their Twitter account performance. And then of course, all kinds of improvements on the writing experience itself. So when we started seeing this growth and realized that it was growing that way with just like a very basic feature set that was almost like just a start of what Typholy could be, we realized that there's so much we can do here to make this growth compound. And so that's when we realized probably we should start investing more time into it. And of course, if you have multiple products, it's a struggle. It's not that obvious what you should work on. And that's also why recently we started discussing almost weekly our roadmap and what we should work on, because it's so easy to start working for weeks and weeks or even months on something and then realize, wait, maybe we should have prioritized that other product, or maybe we're abandoning maybe too much. We should absolutely shift back to it. So this deviates a little bit from the question, but I just want to mention that it's super important then to also always challenge your assumptions on what you should work on if you have multiple products.
That is actually a very good point, and which reminds me of one query which I have always that so suppose you have a list of features upcoming, so do you prefer or did you prefer that sharing it with the existing users, that this will be our product roadmap, these are the features we will be bringing, or it used to be that build first and then tell the users how it used to be for you?
I don't have a strong opinion on this, so then I'll let Francesco speak on this. But I just want to mention that In the past, we overshared a bit of our roadmap at some point. And usually when you share too much, it's very easy to disappoint users. Because like usually if you want to do 10 things, you actually manage to do five, because it's so easy to underestimate the amount of work that you need for your roadmap. So probably without thinking too much into this, I'd say probably share 20 or 30% of what you want to do, because it's usually what you're probably actually able to achieve in a small time frame. And that's what users care about. Because if you tell users, we're going to have this amazing feature in 2 years, they'll probably say like, I don't care. Or actually, that's super disappointing. I don't want to hear that I have to wait 2 years for that. So I'd recommend probably share just like your next steps with the users. I think it's better. Of course, then if there's a big vision or there are some like macro areas that you know you're going to work on, I think it's pretty fair to share them with users. But it's if it's just a list of features, a very big list of features, probably I'd advise against sharing like all of it with the user base.
Yeah, if I can add to that, a cool way of seeing this is stop looking at users as this people that you need to manage and start. This is a shift that we ourselves did, and look at them like as partners, as people that can give you feedback and can. It's especially if you're an indie hacker and if you build in public. I think it's we have always been shocked by the quality and all the feedback and the support that we got from our users. So we stop thinking of them as these people that we need to micromanage and set expectation of. But we shared more and more of the roadmap with them, and even allow them to vote and decide what we should work on first. And I think this sets expectations. And when you actually see that feature that you voted on shipped, I think it kind of creates this trust and this. This bonding that's really really powerful, because then they are not just users but advocates of your product, and it's I think it's kind of an unfair advantage of the way we do things, and we will lean into that even more, I think, in the future.
Lovely. I hope that answered the questions, Yogini, and
Thank you.
Thank you as well for your question, guys. Do you have to go in exactly 2 minutes, or can we fit one more question before the outro?
Yeah, I think we can take one more. Yeah,
fantastic. It's not my smartest question ever, but I just want to praise you guys a bit more. You've gotten, I think, not just one but two shout outs from David Heinemeier Hansen, DHH. I guess the Basecamp guys are just really loved in this community, you know, because they've pioneered a couple of things. How did that feel? Did you guys expect it? Tell us a bit more about the moments when you've seen the different shoutouts.
Yeah, first of all, it was completely unexpected. And it goes to the power of cold emails, because actually this was born out of a cold email that Fabrizio sent to,
wow,
to David. I mean, for me it was huge, because actually I learned programming by reading Agile Web Development with Rails, which David wrote. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a big moment. We didn't reach out to praise or to we reached out saying, hey, we built this, do you want to try it? Kept it super simple, and actually that's the way that's the kind of email that work. So it was big for us. David even shared a ton of feedback for Mailbrew, so we're pretty happy of this relationship and even the ways it's informing our roadmap, because now it's like it's our prototypical user basically staying informed with only with Mailbrew, completely logged off from Twitter. So, yeah.
Fabrizio, what about you?
Yeah, no, I just want to say that it never gets old. Like when these big personalities share your product, it's always like this big moment of validation where you feel like that it's really working. When those kind of people take the time to write a tweet in some cases, or with David, he even wrote an entire blog post basically about how he uses Mailbrew to stay informed. So that was like very, very nice to read. And I think something worth sharing here is that, first of all, yeah, what Francesco said, like very simple cold emails still work, even with the busy inboxes of people these days. If you write something very concise, on point and tailored to someone that, some person you really like and you want them to try your product, it worked actually a lot of times. Even if it's a small percentage of time, you shouldn't send like two emails, maybe send 30 or 50, but usually some work and some amazing people actually have those 5 or 10 minutes to give it a shot. And I think something that really helped us to make these people try our products is also that extra mile that we usually do where we polish up our products before releasing them. And so these people usually try something that is not just the average MVP where it's really rough around the edges, but it's usually something that they really enjoy using it. There's a ton of work we do to make the kind of magic happen, and I think it works. And of course, this is not true for everything. I mean, if you have a really like the next big thing idea, sometimes it can be very rough around the edges. For example, even Clubhouse, it's not the best example because it's basically dead at this point, but he had like a huge success at the beginning and it was very, very rough around the edges. But in the case, it was such a novel idea, almost without any competition, that you can like forgive them for being, for looking and feeling like an MVP. But then when you have some products in some known categories, or you really want to impress users, even with something that they don't really get very well as soon as they try it, having that extra polish, that very nice user experience that is very well thought out, I think it helps a lot to convert these super busy people with a huge following that usually don't have time to try stuff that doesn't really look right.
And just so we can get the practical as well, I would hate to not ask this. Tell us about the, shortly, because it won't take you too long. Tell us about how many rows that email had, because you said sure, but it's like one row, three rows, and tell us about the title. Because I suppose the title has to be catchy as well, or at least it drew his attention.
I'd have to find it. I probably have a screenshot somewhere, so let me check if I can find it. But I think... I think I found it. Okay, so the title was "I'd love your feedback on our new app, David." So very, very straight to the point and simple. And actually, it wasn't that brief. I'm seeing that it was, I'd say, 4 or 5 tiny paragraphs, just basically one-liners. So four or five one-liners. So like, I'm creating this app that does this and that. It's called Mailbrew and lets you blah, blah, blah. Another sentence. Then you can check it out here. Simple link, simple signature. That's it. So yeah, it doesn't have it doesn't need to be like one sentence. So it can be long if it's super straight to the point. Every sentence is necessary and explains why they should give you those 2 or 3 minutes. That's the point, I think.
That makes sense. Kind of like the Twitter sort of writing where you have a one or two liner just to be concise so that people can follow and skim through it, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. All right, we're getting close to the outro. I usually end an AMA with a cheeky question if it comes to my head. It did come. So you guys are in an AMA. Can I ask you anything? AMA, ask me anything?
For sure, yeah.
Anything?
Yeah, I think so. Like we can just close the space if we don't like the question.
Okay, yeah. On your Mailbrew homepage, in that live iPhone mock-up, the working mock-up, you guys have a subreddit added there, which is Reddit Entrepreneur. What would it take to replace that with Reddit SaaS? Fingers crossed you guys are not closing the room right now.
I actually, like, it's not a problem at all. Like, actually, recently, I haven't read that many Reddit threads. I should actually curate my brews a bit more. And I haven't found Entrepreneur to be too useful recently, so probably a welcome change for the homepage.
There we go. I just took your advice and I shot my shot. It wasn't a cold email, but I listened to you.
Yeah, cold space. Anyway, yeah, bring it.
There we go. There we go. Guys, thank you very, very much for being here today. Is there anything we've missed? Anything else you'd like to add, any of you?
No, it was a great chat. Really, thanks for having us, and already looking forward for the next one.
Thank you as well for coming. Besides Twitter and typefully.app and mailbrew.com, what are the best places to reach you, or is Twitter the best place to reach you guys for following, DMing, or whatever? This is just for the audience.
Definitely Twitter. We're relying more and more on building in public and building our audiences here. So that's perfect.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Absolutely. Twitter.
Fantastic. Lovely. Thanks to everybody who came in today. Thank you for Francesco and Fabrizio for your time. We highly appreciate it. I loved the answers, and I loved, I actually noted it down. One of you said at one point, I don't have a strong opinion on this, which I respect, because it takes a bit of transparency, and you're not lacking any of that, and courage to say, you know what, I don't have the strongest answer here. So I respect that. Appreciate all the thoughtfulness of the answers. Just to tell people, if you have a question at a later point, this AMA continues in text form on Reddit SaaS. That's reddit.com/r/SaaS, or just Google it, I guess. Francesco and Fabrizio are kind enough to answer your questions there. And it's going to be a bit async. So over the next hours, maybe even the next days, if they're going to check it. We've got upcoming AMAs with Chris Messina, the inventor of the hashtag, and you might know him from Product Hunt. Andrew Gazdecki from MicroAcquire, eventually Nathan Berry. Just follow the subreddit, I guess, if you want to be up to speed. So that would be it. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.